91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we feature CNBC Wall Street correspondent Kate Kelly, who will discuss the realm of financial commodity traders. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Those who survive in the tough environment of commodities tend to be smart, aggressive, and egomaniacal individuals. They often flaunt their wealth and operate on gut instinct. Kate Kelly has written The Secret Club That Runs the World, Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. Most shun the media. When markets expand, such as the growth of India and China, so do prices for raw materials. Commodity traders are in the thick of this. We turn with Kate Kelly after NPR and regional news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And as Bonnie and I can attest, at least over the past couple of days, most people know very little about the complex realm of commodity traders. We all just seem to gripe about rising gasoline and food prices and wonder why they then go down. For me, this morning, premium was under $3 a gallon.
Well, hopefully we will get an explanation.
Well, it's easy to figure out how Bill Gates and Warren Buffett amassed billions, Bonnie.
But how do savvy commodity traders operate? We'll speak with CNBC Wall Street reporter and author Kate Kelly. Her latest effort is The Secret Club That Runs the World, Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. And she joins us from CNBC. Welcome, Kate.
Well, thank you for having me, Bonnie. It's a pleasure.
So, because it's a mystery, I thought we'd begin with a lay explanation of exactly what this commodity trading is, using crude oil to illustrate. But first, I've taken a clip from this morning's Marketplace Morning Report with David Brancaccio. Are you familiar with that?
Of course.
Okay, so Paul.
Cheap oil and its effects. The metaphor of the season on financial markets is you should not try to catch a falling knife. The knife, crude oil prices, down 4% yesterday, another 3.2% this morning to $44 and change for a barrel, using the Texas benchmark. This after the oil minister from the United Arab Emirates said OPEC is going to keep pumping and not cut output. The suggestion here is that U.S. shale oil producers should do the cutting. And how does this play out in an economy? There's word this morning that inflation in Britain has vanished. BBC business reporter Russell Padmore is following this. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning to David.
Well, the U.K. is a land of many virtues, but I guess it's not a place to find, at this point, any inflation.
Yeah, British inflation fell to its lowest in December in almost 15 years. You can all put it down to the price of oil falling in significant terms. The price of gasoline at the pump has fallen about 18% since its peak in 2012. That puts more money back in the pockets of consumers. If they have that money to spend, they are going to hopefully down the line drive the economy in the UK forward.
But you can't overdo it when it comes to prices that are stagnant or falling. Is there any concern being expressed by UK's central bank?
Well, there is a bit of a worry that we could get to the Eurozone problem. The European Union is very concerned that falling prices could end up in a downward spiral that sparks deflation. The central bank here, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, is going to get a letter from the governor of the central bank, Mark Carney, explaining why inflation is not at its target level. The Bank of England effectively has to get the old-fashioned typewriter out and write an explanation letter. We'll get to see that letter in February, David.
Right. I can hardly wait. The BBC's Russell Padmore in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Okay, Kate, could you break that down for us?
I'm happy to break that down. I think what I would focus on, though, just the premise of that interview, which is the fact that we've seen very surprisingly cheap crude oil and as a result, cheap gasoline. And then, of course, there are economic impacts, including the possibility of deflation, which is something we're talking about in the U.S. as well as in the U.K. right now. But putting the inflation issue aside just for a moment, what does it mean when oil is cheap? And how do we know that it's even cheap? So it's trading at about $45, both in the U.S. and around the globe in what's known as the Brent crude market. $45 is cheap relative to where crude was last year, even. For a number of recent years, we had crude oil trading in the $100 per barrel range. Now it's clearly at less than half of that. So it's fallen quite a bit, and in a relatively short period of time, in a matter of months. That means, as your colleague was just saying, that purchasing gasoline at the pump, gasoline being a byproduct of crude oil, is much, much cheaper for people. I say around the world, the price of gasoline differs in different countries depending on whether it's subsidized or taxed or so on. But certainly in the U.S. and in parts of Europe, it's a heck of a lot cheaper. What does all of this mean? Well, initially at least, and maybe for a long time to come, cheap gasoline is going to be good for the American consumer, and consumer spending is a huge aspect of the American economy. So if consumer spending lifts because you have more money left over from your paycheck after gassing up your car, that will probably be a good thing for economic growth, and the same is going to be true in other economies. So that's probably a very, very good thing. On the other hand, the reason there's much wringing of hands in the professional trading markets about cheap crude is a lot of reasons, but one of them is that the drilling business in the U.S., the business of looking in the ground and in recent years in shale rock formations for deposits of crude oil and natural gas, this shale drilling that has allowed us to be more efficient with our production of oil and natural gas and become more independent in energy and less reliant on foreign suppliers. That whole business may be called into question by $45 oil. Reason being, a lot of this drilling is not economic when you're selling your product for just $45 per barrel. A lot of these companies are reliant upon a higher price level than $45 in order to simply have a profit margin and keep going. So if we stay relatively cheap in the crude oil markets for a sustained period of time, it may become very difficult for this drilling to continue, and we may see bankruptcies, and we may see a situation in which it becomes a little bit tougher to achieve that sought-after energy independence.
Kate, back to our topic of commodity traders. As a boomer, I have images of frenzied men furiously waving their hands in front of price boards. Does that still happen in our digital world?
It happens less, but it hasn't entirely gone away. So the image many, many people have, and you're not the first to bring it up, is basically from Trading Places, which I believe was 1982 or 1983, where you had Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd in the commodities pits in what was known at the time as the New York COMEX, a big trading floor with sort of raucous human beings buying and selling contracts tied to commodities like oil, but actually I think the COMEX in its heyday was known more for some metal trading like silver and gold and other metals, and having this sort of cacophonous physical market. We call it physical because it was human beings trading using pretty rudimentary computers and pieces of paper. That does still go on to an extent, but most of the action has moved on to computer screens. So you see your kind of typical commodity trader in this day and age working at a desktop, just like many, many office workers do. Maybe they have multiple flat screens because they're looking at different charts of different markets, and they have a screen open for their email and a screen open for their instant messaging. And there's probably a screen, or at least a minimized portion of a screen, that's open to the market for the commodity they trade. And that might be what we call the ICE. That might be the London Metal Exchange. It depends on what commodity it is. But most of it is done, as they say, on the screen these days, and it's far quieter.
Now, this oil, were commodity traders responsible for it going so low? And are they still making money even though oil is so low?
So that is a great question and one that's hard to answer.
Okay.
Let's take the responsibility portion. So the operative theory, or at least the operative concern, among many market watchers in the last, let's call it 6 or 7 years, has been that speculators, which are a type of trader that trades commodities not because they have to buy them or they have to sell them, as an airline has to buy them, for example, or an oil driller probably wants to sell them, but because it's their job. Maybe they're a hedge fund. Maybe they work at a bank. Maybe they're in the financial markets in some way. They might even be a casual trader who's operating from a home office, but they're sort of trading it for its own sake on a commodity equivalent of the stock market. So do these speculative traders impact prices? Well, the short answer is, of course they do. But I think that probably their impact is more of sort of magnitude of a movement down or up that's already occurring than it is to actually turn a market around where it's going up to turn it down or vice versa. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is that a big portion of the market still is the commercial trader, the trader like the airline or like the driller that has a very direct physical involvement in commodity trading. Maybe they're producing a commodity, or as I said, if they're buying airline fuel, they're buying it. So they use these commodity versions of the stock market to hedge their exposure, to sell a little if they're buying it, or vice versa. So they're still keeping the market at where its perhaps more natural level would be if there were no speculators. That said, when speculators have a consensus about whether prices are going up and down, and when they're involved in the market to a large degree, I do think that they can change the magnitude of a move up or down. And in my book, I talk about some examples of where people theorize that that occurs. Now, I say theorize because there's really no demonstrable evidence, guys, of why people make a trade. Trading, whether it's stocks or commodities, is sort of inherently emotional. No matter how much research you're doing on the entities that you're trading, there's an element of emotion that's going to go into decisions. So it's hard to ascribe causation to a particular buy or sell order, and then it's hard to break it down and say who's responsible for this move. But I do think that when oil was super expensive, and the peak was in 2008, shortly before our financial crisis here in the U.S., there was a great deal of concern that speculators were driving prices up on Americans, on consumers, buying fuel and airline tickets and so on. And there was an effort that's kind of still ongoing to regulate these speculators so that they could have less of an impact on the future. The reality is we just don't know how strong the impact really was.
Well, we're going to get to regulation, which you mentioned, and a lot more. We're speaking with Kate Kelly. She's written The Secret Club That Runs the World Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. We'll be right back.
We are here to try to explain to you what it is we do here.
We are commodities brokers, William. They place their orders with us, and we buy or sell their gold for them.
Tell them the good part.
The good part, William, is that no matter whether our clients make money or lose money, Duke and Duke get the commissions.
Well, what do you think, Valentine?
Well, it sounds to me like you guys are a couple of bookies.
Indeed, they're getting their vigorish, as they say, in that trade. We're speaking with reporter and author Kate Kelly. She also wrote the book Street Fighters, and her latest is The Secret Club That Runs the World Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. Well, we were talking about the gasoline Kate, and how there's a lot of insecurity among the commodity traders. Maybe comedy's right. But so maybe they aren't the club that runs the world.
So I have to say, my book came out in June, and I think you have raised the most commented upon issue about it since then, which is the title, and is it appropriate? So I would say, surely there's a little bit of, perhaps a lot of hyperbole with the title. We're taking some poetic license in the secret club that runs the world. But what I meant to suggest with that, and I do think there's a basis here, and the really the reason I got interested in writing this book is that commodities and the financial markets where they trade are one of the least well understood aspects of the economy and the markets that I have run across in 15 plus years of being a financial reporter. I've worked at the Wall Street Journal. I worked at a metro paper in New York, the New York Observer, as a business reporter. And now I've been at CNBC for going on 5 years, written 2 books. And this was the most obscure area that I had run across where sort of even the average person on Wall Street seem to have the least knowledge about. And yet, there's a very small and secretive group of people that operates actively in these commodity markets, and they do have an impact. In many cases, they're involved in the physical side of the market as well as this contract side of it. And what I mean by that is maybe they're actually taking physical deliveries of huge cargo ships full of oil and reselling it, as well as trading, making wagers like the Duke brothers did in Trading Places on these commodity futures markets. Maybe they're buying huge amounts of physical copper or physical cocoa beans in London. And there are real examples of this both in my book and in the headlines recently, moves that very well could affect perception of supply and demand in those markets and as a result affect prices. So I would argue that this is a obscure but powerful group that people need to know more about.
Well, let's take the other part of the title. If they're a secret club, would you call them? How were you able to penetrate them and that world to research and write the book?
I'm so glad you asked that, because that was one of the more entertaining aspects of doing this book. So it was really hard. I mean, I'm accustomed to people sort of shunning the spotlight as a business reporter. And I'm certainly willing to badger people and go through side doors and go through different routes to get to them. But this really put my skills to the test. You know, some people I was able to call directly and say, hey, I'm doing a book. I'd like to meet with you and see if you'd be willing to be interviewed on the record and at greater length. And that worked a fraction of the time. But most of the time it was, you know, numerous requests and maybe finding a mutual acquaintance or two who might put in an introductory word for me, and then maybe we'd have a sit-down meeting and talk a bit more from there and go from there. I had a couple of characters who spent a good deal of time with me and were very interesting in terms of their own personal backgrounds and their philosophies on trading, but just wouldn't tell me enough about what they were actually doing in the markets, even a year ago, you know, even if it was no longer immediately relevant, so that I ended up putting them on the book version of the cutting room floor because I didn't feel that I had enough insight to write about them. But there was an elusiveness that I just wasn't used to. I mean, as a reporter who's done any sort of investigative work, I think you find that the challenge is to get sort of an initial meeting with someone, to just meet them face to face and establish a bit of trust. And once you've done that, you can call them or text them or email them and, you know, have a pretty good chance of connecting. But with these folks, I would try time and time again to meet them. And it was always like the first time, you know. I would have to go through a lot of rigmarole to get their attention. And often it involved flying to Europe and just kind of showing up at their office. And once I was there, they were willing to talk, but it was scheduling it that was kind of a bear. So they really were quite elusive in that regard. And I guess it's because, you know, some of them have little use for the media. They feel like media scrutiny only brings negativity. Some of them, I think, realize that they're just sort of lightly regulated and they don't want the attention that might come from a media interview and lead to questions about whether there should be more regulation. So there might be any number of reasons, but it was definitely a tough world to try to observe and get involved with.
How about more about this whiz kid, the French whiz kid? Peter, is it Andoran?
Pierre Andoran, exactly. Yes, he was an interesting character to write about. I mean, this was a guy who a Frenchman, as you said, and a competitive swimmer who had dreams of going to the 1996 Olympics, realized in university that he probably wasn't quite fast enough and kind of went through an emotional funk for a while trying to figure out what his next step was before landing a job at Goldman Sachs as a commodity trader. And to make a long story short, he had a lot of quantitative skills. He was very good in mathematics. But I think he also developed sort of this gut sense of how commodity markets and oil especially ebb and flow and what kind of triggers in the market would lead to a rise in price or a fall in price, because he had some exposure to, as I described it earlier, that physical side of the business. He worked probably during a very impressionable period of his early career at Vitol, which is a company that deals quite a bit in physical oil and other physical deliveries of commodities. So they have that direct insight into who's buying it, where, which ports are seeing the most deliveries and which ones are seeing less deliveries than they were in the past, and how are price dynamics changing at the micro level. So once he had the sort of dots in that pointillistic picture, he was able to develop more of a gut sense of how these markets traded and ultimately opened a hedge fund called Blue Gold that had one of the most successful years in the trading markets of any that are known in commodity markets. He made 209% returns for the year 2008, where we saw the very most expensive oil ever, and also a huge fall from there by the end of the year. And he basically called both of those moments. So he deserves a place in history, at least of commodity market trading, for all of that. I should note that this is such a volatile market, a volatile slice of our financial markets, that since that 2000, he had some up years, he had a very tough down year, he closed Blue Gold, it was a bit rancorous for a while, he reopened within the last 18 months or so a new fund called Onderon Capital, and once again, last year, he was up about 38%, according to reports, because, again, he had uncannily good timing in figuring out where crude oil was going to go. And in this case, it was down.
Hmm. Let's invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Do you understand commodity trading, or would you like to? You can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at WLRN.org. Kate, I'd like to go over some of this regulation, because who does regulate and oversee this commodity market, or does anybody?
Yes. So in the U.S., it's the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And the thing about the CFTC is it's even less well-known than the SEC, which is responsible for corporations and stocks, and managed money, particularly on the stock and bond side. But the CFTC deals with futures, which are a big class of traded entities that includes commodities, as well as commodities. And they've also become responsible in recent years for something known as the swaps market, which is this huge and very lightly regulated, at least until recently, market for products that aren't easily traded on an exchange, but rather are agreements between party A and party B to trade something at a certain price at a certain time and are governed by a contract. That sort of off-exchange market, if you will, was a huge factor in the 2008 financial crisis and kind of came to public attention in its wake, and is a hundreds of trillions of dollar market that the CFTC is now responsible for. So anyway, the CFTC is the short answer. They have this huge purview, but a far smaller staff and a smaller budget than the SEC, which tells you something about how much they're able to accomplish.
Well, wasn't this Dodd-Frank supposed to affect commodity trading? Regulate
it? It was, and it has, and you're quite right to bring it up. I mean, after the financial crisis, the Dodd-Frank Act was passed, and there were a number of measures in there intended to bring greater scrutiny and greater limitations upon commodity traders' abilities. Only some of it's been implemented. The swaps market that I mentioned has come under more scrutiny, and the CFTC was able to establish a couple of mechanisms for bringing greater accountability and just greater transparency to the swaps market, which I think many would agree, although not all, is probably generally to the public good, so that to the extent that there are risks out there from the commodity market, at least we kind of know what they are. But another aspect of the CFTC's remit as a result of Dodd-Frank was to curb the size of positions or trades that commodity traders could take in the market, something known as position limits. And that has been around and around in terms of a proposal that was passed by the leadership of the CFTC, only not to be enacted. In one case in 2012, a federal judge in D.C. shot down a package of position limits that had already been agreed to. There's a new proposal that's been voted in by the CFTC that's kind of circling through, but it's unclear whether it will become an effective rule and regulation because the political backing for this type of reform is diminishing and probably is even more diminished with our new Congress now.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Kate Kelly. She's a best-selling author who covers Wall Street and hedge funds for CNBC, among other things. She's written The Secret Club That Runs the World Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. We'll take a short break and we'll return.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also, of course, reporter and author Kate Kelly. We're talking about her book, The Secret Club That Runs the World, Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. Also on our topical currents Facebook page, you'll find links to that book and to Kate Kelly. Kate, tell us about the relationship between commodities and the stock market. How do they work together?
So they don't work terribly closely together, which is one reason that some people like commodities. The reason that commodity investments were pitched successfully to sort of the average mom or pop investor or maybe the average pension fund, as they were in the 2000s, is that they were considered to be uncorrelated to the stock market and to other typical investments that people might have, like the broad bond market. Commodities are a group that do well during periods of broad economic expansion, as we were seeing in the early 2000s. And they may not behave badly necessarily just because the stock market is behaving badly. So thus, they're uncorrelated. So that's a reason why people got involved in them. There were also these commodity indexes that were growing in size during that decade. And they worked pretty well as long as sort of prices of commodities were going up and the technicalities of owning those indexes, which involves taking existing contracts that expire, replacing them with new ones. As long as those economics worked well for everybody, they were pretty successful investments for that period of time. But, you know, in 2008, when we saw a huge peak in most commodities, most notably oil, and then a crash to much lower levels in just really a six-month period, the popularity of those vehicles started to come into question. And what you've seen more recently is a real retreat from commodities, with CalPERS, the California Pension Fund, perhaps leading the way, but other pension funds saying that they're disinterested too. So, you know, really that professional commodity investing asset class is a shadow of what it once was, even though for those that have the stomachs to take a lot of risk, there are still good returns to be made.
Can we go back to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission? Who are the people? How are they appointed, elected? Who are they, the people that make it up, the commissioners?
Sure. So it's similar in structure to the SEC. What you've got is a panel of commissioners. When they're fully staffed, I believe it's five. And, you know, four of them that are political appointees, and then someone who's the chairperson who needs to be confirmed by the Senate. Right now, it's a gentleman named Tim Massad. Before that, it was a gentleman named Gary Gensler. But the CFTC, as I mentioned earlier, has gone through a period where, on the one hand, they were invested with great new responsibilities and a real political and public mandate to toughen up the regulation of commodity trading, but also other aspects of what they do, which includes futures and swaps. And at the very same time as they were given this mandate, sort of starved to some degree of budget dollars and staff. So they've operated without a full commission. So in other words, with less than five people for a period of time. And that has made it hard for them to get things done. They've got mechanisms there that are very old school. It can take them quite a while to put out reports and do things. And it's been a real issue. The political disagreement over some of what they're trying to do, the lack of staffing even at the senior level, and then the sort of just dated systems that they have mean that they just haven't been as effective as perhaps they could be.
What's the most volatile commodity that's traded frequently?
That's a great question. Commodities in general are quite volatile. And I think the smaller the market, the less popular it is and the less people who are part of it, the more volatile it probably is. So in some of these smaller markets like cotton, for example, that's a much smaller pool of people trading than, say, oil. You might see greater volatility. But I think oil is a great example, even though it's highly liquid, as they say in the markets, or in other words, populous. Oil is incredibly volatile. And as we've seen it go from, just in the pretty recent past, from about $80 to the mid 40s in a couple of months here, I've had traders tell me people need to stop thinking of the crude oil market as they would the stock market or an individual stock. An individual stock has certain kind of technical levels where it's tough for that stock to trade too much lower because there's kind of a natural floor that's created based on their earnings, based on their cash flow, based on their balance sheet. And there might even be a natural ceiling as well based on those same factors. And until something changes dramatically in terms of their assets and liabilities and what's in their near future in terms of business events, they're not going to move dramatically. This trader's been telling me, oil is just not the same. There's really no floor to where it might go. And in this case, what we have going on, and I find this very interesting, is that the OPEC countries, notably Saudi Arabia, these overseas producer nations who get together and kind of talk about overseas production, i.e. non-U.S. production, and where it is and whether they're getting the prices that they expect to see for their supply and whether they want to lower their production levels so that they can perhaps see a higher price. OPEC has basically gotten together and said, we're not going to cut production, even though prices are going lower, both in the U.S. and globally. We're not cutting production. We can stand to see lower prices for a while. And the thinking is that Saudi Arabia is trying to put the heat on the U.S. and saying, all right, guys, you've been very productive and very efficient in recent years. You guys in the U.S. want to achieve energy independence. So let's see how that goes. Prices might get awfully low. And unless you start to cut that shale production, you're not going to see higher prices. So now that's exactly what's going on. OPEC is refusing to cut their production levels. The U.S. is continuing apace because the U.S. drillers have their own motivations for wanting to keep the drilling going, even at a cheaper price. And we're seeing it go lower and lower and lower, and there's really no resistance level. Many people are now saying, look for a price in the high 30s for crude oil, which is super, super low relative to recent years.
So what does this do for the incentive for alternate energy?
Well, that's a great question. In terms of alternative energy, I think the mandate lessens a little bit mm-hmm. when you have cheap oil. And we recently had an environmentalist on CNBC, a guy who used to be a hedge fund trader, now runs an environmental charity. And I put this question to him. And he said, well, look, an environmentalist ultimately has to be in favor of people and people, consumers. And if they're benefiting from cheaper gasoline, then that's something we all have to embrace. And think about the technology and the technological advances that we've seen in recent years and how those are going to move us toward alternative energies, even if gas is so compellingly cheap. So, for example, fuel-efficient vehicles, right? Maybe we have the Chevy Volt or at the high end, the Tesla. People are really embracing these new automobiles that rely less on gas, and they're going to be happy with that technology and efficiency, even if gas remains cheap. I'm not sure I 100% agree. I do think the pressure comes off of folks to focus on alternatives at a time when gas is so cheap. So, for example, you saw the Cape Wind project up in Massachusetts hit a huge skid recently where permits that they needed to develop this wind farm weren't approved. Now, there are obviously local and regional reasons for that, and there was some opposition to the project, perhaps not on environmental grounds, but on grounds of, you know, land being affected and views being destroyed and so on. But I think you might see more impetus for a project like that if we were still in a very, very high oil price environment.
Something else that just interested me, just to go back to this, you say this is a fraternity of whip smart, aggressive, and often egomaniacal men, for they're nearly all men. So my question is that by choice, or are women not welcome in this group?
So that's a good question. You know, there was a commodity executive I met in the course of this, and I was giving the person some pushback as to why there weren't more women at senior levels in his company. And he said, you know what, show me a woman who wants to travel 80% of the time, and I'll put them on my board or in my executive suite. That's a very anecdotal answer to your question, and I'm sure there are women who would be willing to travel to that degree. But for whatever reason, it's been an industry that hasn't attracted or at least sustained the careers of a lot of women. I did make a huge effort to have at least one semi-significant female character in my book, and that was Jennifer Fan,
right,
who was sort of this mathematics wunderkind from Pittsburgh, who wound up graduating from high school and college at a very young age and ending up at Morgan Stanley, I want to say at the age of 20, as a commodity trader and becoming very successful. You know, she is sort of an exception, and she described the environment to me as not necessarily anti-female by any means, but just predominantly male, very raucous, very loud. And she was able to sort of bond with her colleagues by just getting lost in the sort of quantitative analysis and playing parlor games attached to logic and math and other interests that she had. But, you know, for whatever reason, this just is not a female dominated industry, and I'm not sure quite why. Having said that, I should note the first female to ever be a co-head of capital markets at Goldman Sachs is Isabelle Ealet, a French woman and a former oil trader who ran their commodities division. At J.P. Morgan, the head of commodities and the person who really grew that business from very little to a multi-billion dollar business unit was a woman, English woman named Blythe Masters. Now, for reasons having nothing to do with gender, she has left the company and they've downsized that. But there are some notable strides that women are making.
You want to take a call or take a break?
We'll take our break right now and return with the callers. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with reporter and author Kate Kelly. We're talking about commodity traders. And we'll take our first phone call. This is Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, like most people, I'll readily admit that the commodities seems more like a shell game than anything else, but has a really drastic impact on day-to-day life for the average person. But with that being said, as far as I know, the marijuana trade, since, you know, at least I can remember, since the 70s, has never been subsidized by any government or agency, but the product cannot be cut, therefore, not unlike, you know, cocaine. So you're getting the straight product sold by weight, but the price has never changed in almost 30 years. So I don't understand how that can be possible, especially with some of these record drug seizures. And it is almost like a commodity, and was actually a commodity, if I remember right, before it was outlawed at the turn of the century. So can anyone comment on that? It doesn't make fiscal sense.
Any insight?
Dwight,
there,
I have
Kate?
To say yeah, I really don't know very much about the marijuana market. I apologize. I got to take a pass on that one. But I would say, in terms of considering it a commodity, absolutely. I mean, a commodity in the financial market is anything that sort of has the same chemical and elemental properties, regardless of its origin. So if it fits that description, sure. But I must say, I don't know. I don't know if Bonnie and Joseph have any thoughts on that one.
No, I don't.
No. Okay, we have an emailer. Josh asks if you would agree the FINRA FINRA suitability rules should be required for the discount brokers as well to prevent devastating losses for most of their day trading currency and commodities trading customers. He said most customers do not have a license, training, or experience, and they hide behind, "We only offer self-directed accounts." Are you...
Interesting. Well, so suitability rules are sort of what they sound like, which is essentially, are you making investment recommendations and putting customers into investments that are suitable for them, considering the capital that they have to invest and what their risk tolerance is and so on. So I think it's obviously a great idea to apply that concept to anybody that's advising an investor on what to do. In terms of whether the suitability rules that FINRA imposes should be extended to that additional aspect of the market, you know, I'm not familiar with all the details on that one. I would guess that to the extent that the discount brokers aren't held to that standard, maybe it has to do with what they would argue is a lack of resources to train all of their brokers and middlemen in the suitability standard. And I think in terms of the discount brokers, I assume he's referring to like an E-Trade or a TD Ameritrade. You've got people there that are day trading and sort of doing their own thing in many cases, may not want that flavor of advice. If they did, they might go to a more traditional broker. But I'm not taking a side here. I'm not exactly sure what the market dynamics are, but that would be my initial reaction. Okay. It might be something worthy of further study.
I also was wondering, you know, you think of some of these poorer countries from whence many of these commodities originate. Do they ever reap the benefits, or are the only people who reap the benefits the commodity traders?
So that's a great point, Bonnie, and something I really debated putting much more focus on in the book. In the end, I stuck with the dynamics of these trading markets. Who are some of the individuals that trade in them, and how do they do what they do? How do they affect markets? But there is absolutely a whole aspect of the story that deals with developing countries that are commodity rich, but not rich in terms of their economies. And you've got commodity purveyors that operate in many of these places, and they're places that the average company sort of fears to dwell. One good example is Glencore. Glencore, one of the biggest commodity trading firms out there now. It's now publicly traded, and probably two of my favorite sections in the book deal with Glencore's origins. Their forerunner company was Mark Rich & Company. Mark Rich, of course, being a famous American fugitive who lived out the rest of his life in Switzerland after being charged with tax evasion and trading with the enemy by prosecutors in the U.S. This is a company he founded, later sold it to some of his colleagues, and died somewhat recently. But Glencore operates in a number of developing countries, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, including Colombia, where there have been issues of environmental concerns or even violence. They were accused in a recent documentary film of having child labor going on a property that they owned and subleased, and they have denied involvement with this. So for anybody that's interested in this, there are a couple of documentaries that have been made on it, films, one of which is called Stealing Africa, that's quite interesting. And I would just say it raises very good moral questions. One interesting story is about the involvement of commodity traders in the country of Zambia, which sold a number of its mining assets in 2008 at a time when it was economically hamstrung. And in the end, you would expect that they would see a piece of the returns from those mines because of taxes or at least employment. I'm not saying there's been zero benefit, but independent studies have shown that because they agreed to provide electricity to some of these miners at a deep discount, they actually have ended up in the red. So at a minimum, some of these economic arrangements should probably be rethought in order to help benefit the countries that are hosting these mining activities. Right. But that's just one of many examples that are raised when you look at this world.
Kate Kelly, who was the commodity trader who booked Elton John for a birthday party?
Oh, that was Pierre Anderand, our French boy wonder and Olympic hopeful. He had a very over-the-top wedding in St. Petersburg a few years ago, and it involved Elton John, the Bolshoi Ballet, Craig David. Furniture was flown in from London. And this is just kind of an example of the sort of excess that you sometimes see by people that are successful in commodity markets or markets. And, you know, share their wealth through big events and things like that. But that was one that really made some of the newspapers. His wife is a former model of Russian origin. So that's why the St. Petersburg location. But there's a little bit of color in the book about how Pierre spent his money. And you know, I visited him at a chateau he rented in the south of France during the summer of 2012. And it was this enormous place with 10 bedrooms, and at the time it was just him and Jania, his wife, and their baby daughter and the baby's grandmother. Now, I think they had other friends coming, but it was just this enormous estate for what started out as a pretty small group. And, you know, he had his custom-made car parked in the garage. So, you know, some examples of what his success in the oil markets has done for him were right there in living color.
You know, since this is a worldwide phenomenon, commodity trading, is there anybody who oversees it worldwide? Or can, if you're in Switzerland, you can do one thing that you can't do in the United States? Or if you're in France, like, you know, Pierre Anderand, is there any international regulatory agency?
Not really, no. You have disparities from one region to another in terms of what the rules are. I think there has been some effort to harmonize what the standards are in the U.S. Versus the U.K. China is another case. China has a very active and booming commodity market. They're starting to open up their commodity markets more officially to foreigners, but they have their own rules of play. There has been an international attempt to harmonize banking standards and risk management standards through the Basel agreements, which is a whole other topic. Basel is a Swiss-based organization that's been trying to work with financial overseers in many jurisdictions to make sure that everybody's on the same playing field. And they've done a fair bit of that with international banks. But on commodity trading specifically, there's less of that. The thing that you commodity traders is there's typically only one market that's the very most active and sort of easy to trade venue for a given product, whether it's oil or gold or copper. So to the extent that people congregate on a single market, whether it's based in London or whether it's based in New York or Atlanta, you see regulation on those markets that everybody has to honor. But there is a disparity between what goes on here and what goes on in other places. And partly because of that, you saw a lot of U.S.-based commodity trading operations moving to their London offices in larger size in the wake of 2008.
Kate, you've compiled this book. It's taken you about 3 years. Are there any kind of regulatory reforms you would suggest?
Well, I think there's much debate about the position limits, and I hesitate to come out too strongly on one side or the other, but it does seem to me that position limits were called for by Dodd-Frank, and it's inefficient to say the least that here we are 4.5 years later and we still don't have them, and taxpayer time and money is still being used up debating this over and over again. So I would love to see some more clarity on position limits. I think that's one thing that could help sort of rein in some of the activity. But people would disagree with me strongly and say there's no evidence that speculators are impacting prices. And if anything, speculators help keep the markets in natural balance and help tamp down volatile moves one way or the other. So I'm sure there are those who would disagree. I basically think it would be nice to see just a more concerted viewpoint and a more concerted effort behind it in the U.S. as to what we need to do. For example, if we're going to ask for position limits, if we're going to empower the CFTC to do more, let's put some conviction behind that and fully staff the place and give it a full budget to work with. If we want to starve it for resources and unwind some of what was already done, let's go ahead and do that. But we're in this very uncomfortable middle zone where rules aren't being implemented because it's just so technically difficult to do so. Mm-hmm. And that's probably not good for anyone. So I think there's that. And I just would love to see more national attention to these markets and how they operate, and whether there's a need for more regulation, because I think there's a lot of mystery here and a lot of anger in terms of what speculators may or may not be doing. And a bit of education and a bit more transparency would go a long way to demystify some of it, but also shine a light on things that are problematic. To raise one example, you know, Senator Levin, the Democrat of Michigan who recently retired, spent a good deal of time on commodity trading with his permanent subcommittee on investigations, and came out with some pretty compelling findings just a couple of months ago on how the banks had been involved in commodities over the years, and there were some really problematic practices. So it would be great to see more dialogue around that.
Well, we're going to have to be running.
Kate Kelly is a best-selling author, covers Wall Street and hedge funds for CNBC, previously with the Wall Street Journal. She's written The Secret Club That Runs the World, Inside the Fraternity of Commodity Traders. Do you understand more, Joe?
Yes.
So do I. Thank you, Kate Kelly.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your listening this hour. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. If you have discussion items, find the Topical Currents Facebook page. Also, more information and links are there. You can listen again at WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. We return Thursday with a program which starts with a discussion of how citizens can counter the cynicism and dysfunction of government and become involved. And Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. We'll have the winner of the Miss Universe pageant cooking contest. It took place in Doral. Contestants make typical dishes of their homeland, Bonnie.
Nice.
This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.